This is the next part of the Looking Glass podcast, where we interview people who used to work for Looking Glass and have them talk about their work on some of their influential games. And we're very fortunate today to be speaking with Ken Levine. Ken, just introduce yourself.
I am Ken. I guess I'm the creative director now of Irrational Games. I started my career, though, at Looking Glass back in 95. A long time ago.
95?
95,
and
yeah.
It's 2011.
I think it is, yeah.
So one of the way I've started the other podcast is by mentioning that one of our kind of themes for this podcast is we've called it Searching for Authorship. So we're looking at getting people to talk about what they remembered from the projects they worked on at Looking Glass,
Yep. What
they remember in terms of, you know, contributing to those projects, which ideas came from where, at least in their memory. It's like an oral history. So we could just start by you talking about how you got into the company and like what some of the first projects were or how that, because I heard you were in screenwriting before that, or this is one of the things I've heard. So
yeah, I started my sort of professional career when I was still in college. Got an agent and stuff, and in LA, and I was sort of had a brief couple year long period where I was doing what you call spec scripts, meaning writing scripts and helping somebody buy them. And then I eventually got hired right out of college, shortly after college, to do what they call a rewrite for Paramount, which is, you know, they take an existing script and they bring another writer on. Whenever you go to the movies and you see, like, written by so-and-so, it doesn't mean they all sat in the same room. It means one guy wrote for a while, got fired, another guy wrote for a while, got fired, and they kept hiring new writers. And I was, you know, number whatever in line on that movie. The movie never got made, but they paid me, so I was, you know, pretty happy about that. But then I sort of, that career sort of fizzled out, and I was a computer consultant and a graphic designer, and I moved to New York from LA, and I was in New York, and you know, I played, the one consistent thing was I played games, you know, I just was a gamer, I was always a gamer. And I started thinking, like, well, what if I got a job in the games industry?
And you're in New York at the time.
I was in New York at the time. And trying to be a playwright and, like, on the side and doing, you know, graphic design and consulting, computer consulting on Wall Street. And then I saw an ad for Looking Glass, which is a company I love. I adored Looking Glass. An ad for a job there as a game designer. I'm like, I'll do that. And surprising to me, with I didn't really have any real qualifications, they ended up finding me up there for an interview, and then they ended up hiring me, and I was so thrilled. I mean, I remember the computer consulting firm I worked at on Wall Street was like, well, stay at the company, we'll make you a partner. And I just said to the guys, who were really nice guys, I said, there's literally nothing you can offer me that'll keep me from taking this job. So I respect you guys, I like you guys, but there's just nothing you can offer me. I want to do this so badly. And, you know, I got the job, and I moved up to Boston and started Looking Glass.
Did you, and so you had played some of the Looking Glass games before that?
Like, yeah.
Which ones do you remember making an impression on you?
All of them. You know, I wasn't a huge non-combat flight fan, so I didn't really play a lot of Flight Unlimited, but, which I think came out before I got there. I can't remember. The first one came out, I think, before I got there. I played, obviously, Ultima Underworld 2, System Shock 1, you know, huge impression on me.
Did you play it, like, when it first came out, System Shock 1?
I played it when the CD version came out.
Okay.
I remember looking at it. It was weird, because I went to work on, you know, so I worked on the sequel, but I remember I looked at the, even though I like Looking Glass, I looked at the box for System Shock 1, and it was such a strange bird that I could not figure out what kind of game
it was.
You
mean that weird face with the eyes?
Yeah, it was a weird face with the eyes, which is, you know, Rob Waters did that cover, and it was an awesome piece of art. But I looked at the front, I looked at the back, and I just didn't know what it was.
It doesn't tell you what the game is about,
really.
It's a good image, but it doesn't communicate.
It doesn't communicate. Yeah. The whole package did not communicate what the game was, and eventually I heard enough good things that I was like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot, and I played it, and, you know, 2 minutes in. Oh, I played the non-audio, because originally it didn't have any audio.
Did you play the disc floppy version?
I played a demo of the disc floppy, and it just did not register with me. Then when I played the audio version with the CD, I was like, Oh, I get this. I get this. I get what this is. Right from the very first room, you know, where you have all, you know, Rebecca, I can't remember her last
Rebecca name. Lansing.
Rebecca Lansing speaking to you. I was just like, sold, you know, sold. Yeah. And I was just, I love that game. And just, you know, to get a chance to work at this company where I was such a huge fanboy of, it was just, as my first job, it's just a ridiculous stroke of luck.
So when you first started to work there, like, do you remember, like, acclimatizing to the company and, like, what your first project was, or?
Yeah. I mean, it was a weird place. Like, it was a collection of odd ducks, myself included.
And this would have been what year? Just
95. I started in October 95, and for my first day I got there, it was not a particularly organized place. I had no desk. I had no project. I had no boss, really. I was just like, it was like, here you go, Ken, welcome to the office. And I remember being like, what do I do? Like, I had no idea what to do, and nobody really told me. So the first whole day there, I didn't have a desk. I would just sort of wander around the office. Didn't know anybody. It was a really strange...
Were you trying to find stuff to do? Like, what were you hired as?
A game designer. But I didn't really know what that was, because I'd never been one before.
Okay.
So it wasn't like I, you know, done a job before, and I'd come and I sat down, okay, I'm a carpenter, I'm going to start building, you know...
Did they give you a game to design?
They gave me nothing. It was like, welcome to the office, Ken. There's no desk for you. There's no computer for you. I'm like half about to sneeze. And here it is. So the second day I remember I was there, I started getting really concerned. And I was like, well, what I like to do when I'm in a situation where I don't know what to do and I feel really powerless is I try to take authority. So I said, well, there's a movie theater across the street. I'm going to go to the movies. At least I'll know what I'm doing then. And I went to the movies and I came back. And all of a sudden, people were like, oh, Ken, here's a desk for you. We know what you're working on now. Like, it took them all just a couple of days to get their heads around having a new employee. And I remember as soon as I came back, everything solidified a lot more from the movies. But I just didn't know what to do. I felt really awkward just standing there with no desk. So I just left and came back. And nobody cared. Like, it wasn't like it was like, oh, were you at the movies? And you're getting a demerit. You know, it's like, it was such a weird, it's much more like a university being at Looking Glass than it was. Huh. You know the kind of freedom you feel when you first went to college compared to high school? Did you go to public school?
Yes.
Yeah, you know the feeling when you go to college, it's like, oh, wait, nobody's going to tell
me.
Nobody's going to make me do stuff. There's no hall monitors
or anything. Yeah.
That's what going to Looking Glass is like. It was like you're used to jobs where people actually care about where you are and what you're doing.
Yeah.
Looking Glass is just like, yeah, we're just kind of here making games, and it'd be cool if you did some cool stuff. You know, I may be misremembering the extreme of that, but certainly it was way more like that than any company.
Yeah, you were struck by the flexibility and kind of formlessness.
It was very formless. Yeah. Yes, and that was, I think, part of the reason. I think in that formlessness, it's both its success and its financial non-success came out of. You know, that it's because it was so formless, you could have that kind of creative energy. Mm-hmm. But it was also a tough place, I think, to think of as a business that's designed to ship software and make money. It wasn't a great structure for that kind of, it wasn't a structure.
Well, yeah, like one of the things that's come up on this podcast with the people we've already talked to is just how experimental projects started out being. It was not even so much about like, we want to make this game. It was like, we want to simulate this world. And then only like a year or two later, you'd be like, oh, maybe we should make this into a game.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that is, for better or for worse, how I learned how to make games. Like Thief was, you know, about a week after I was there, somebody said, okay, we want you to spend time with Doug Church, and working on this new thing that at the time was just called Action RPG. They just had these vague titles for things, like Action RPG, RPG. Like, I remember Paul Narath used to get up on the board and show what the product plan was for the next few years, which is pretty impressive, because I don't think I've ever done like that here. And he's like, and then the titles were always like Action RPG, Flight Combat Game, RPG, you know, things like that. And,
So you were working on action RPG as opposed to RPG.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea was to combine RPG elements and action elements. And basically, Doug and I were in a room, and I met Doug, and I was a big fan of his work. And sort of like getting put in the room with Spielberg on your first week, and you have no experience of any kind. And he was very generous in terms of, he did not treat me like, who is this slob, which he probably should have. things. What did I know? But he was very collaborative, and we just started talking about what we wanted to do. And we started homing in on a few concepts, and those concepts became, you know, eventually all that stuff became Thief, but it went through
about, I think it was called Dark Camelot.
It was called many different names. So okay. One of my responsibilities, Patrick, at the time, was sort of come up with the world and what the aesthetic was. So first I came up with something called, originally, like, I think we had something called School for Wizards, which is like about you being a learning, going to the school where they
it was called School for Wizards.
Then I came up with something called Dark Elves Must Die. And then I came up with something called Better Red Than Undead.
Oh, actually, yeah, that's actually something I've heard about that I actually wanted to talk about, is Better Red Than Undead. It's something I've heard about. I've heard Doug talk about it. I've heard several other people talk about it.
It was like a goofy, it was like a 1950s sort of pulp story about you were, because at this point, Doug and I wanted it to be a sword fighting simulator, and you were this character who was like a CIA agent in the 50s. It was sort of this campy story, and you were fighting communists in Russia. There's also a zombie thing going on there. I don't remember all the details, but
there was a combination of those elements, like sword fighting, zombies, communism.
It was like 1950s Cold War story with zombies, with sword fighting. And I think the sword fight is probably the one thing that pushed over, like, sort of where it became like, what does sword fighting have to do with any of it?
Yeah.
But we really wanted to make a first person, at the time, we were focused on making a first person sword fighting simulator. And that's what, you know, through all those iterations, that's sort of what we focused on. And then I think marketing killed that idea. And that was my first real disappointment. Something I was really attached to. Like, I thought the idea...
Was that very far along? A Better Red Than Undead?
I definitely wrote a bunch of documents. So I definitely was... We were doing mission breakouts and things like that. But it was pretty... I mean, relatively early in the process.
Yeah.
And they killed it. And they didn't kill Action RPG. They just said, we think this idea is too far out there. And they're probably right. I don't know. I mean, who knows? And then it became Dark Camelot, I think, after that, which was a retelling of the Arthurian legends, wherein you were Mordred, but you were actually... The idea was that the victors wrote the history, and actually Arthur was an asshole.
Well, he comes off as an asshole anyway in the story, I think, right? It's not that hard to believe that Mordred would be...
Yeah, you and Morgana were actually sympathetic heroes. And actually, you were... the hero version we had, Mordred, was like an African-American... And so it was
Morgana.
It was like they were like African, well, not African American. They're African. They're African
descent. Yeah.
And part of the reason they were being treated the way they were was sort of the whole racial thing.
Oh, I see.
We were sort of playing around with some interesting stuff. Arthur was this really patrician figure, and we just were playing around with some interesting stuff. And I don't know what happened. I don't know why we ended up not going that direction, but that evolved. We had a fair amount of stuff for that, but. There are themes that were coming along that were very common. Like, we really, the thing that Doug and I kept tuning into in our like very late night chats. Sometimes Doug wouldn't come in till 11 o'clock at night, and he'd be there all night. But he would he was very unpredictable.
Like until 6 a.m.
Yeah.
No one.
It was very unpredictable when he'd come in, so I would just sort of wait until Doug came in. Like, I'd go to work during the day and then wait, because frankly it was, you know, it was worth it. He's such a smart guy that. To spend some time with him, you know, and I think, you know, he has very, you know, I think it is, you don't often meet people who I'd classify as, you know, as genius level.
Mm.
I think Doug is definitely in that category. And so, you know, I would wait to spend time with a guy like Doug and to learn from a guy like that. I would definitely go out of my way, and I did. You know, so I'd come in and, you know, he'd just show up, and sometimes he wouldn't even tell me he was there, and I'd be like, and I'd come in his office, I see he was there, and you know, he'd be like on the phone or something, I'd wait and I'd come back, and I'd just get some, you know, 20 minutes or half an hour to go talk about the design with him. Because I think I think it's interesting because I remember being very frustrated with how willing he was to throw ideas out. And I'm like, oh, I come up with all these ideas. This guy keeps throwing them out, and I got very frustrated. But I look at how I work now, and now that's how I work here at Irrational. I just throw so willing to throw ideas
out. So he was very iterative. Like he would...
He was so iterative. And I really... At first, I found that very frustrating. And now I look back on it, I'm like, that's entirely how our working process is here. It's just an iterative process. We throw so much stuff away.
But you never threw out the sword idea, it seems like.
Mm. Moved away from a direct analog control of it. Mm. It was originally a direct analog control.
Oh, were you actually like controlling the sword movement?
And at first person, we just never get that working well. And I remember being really heartbroken when Doug was just like, I just don't think this is going to work. And because he had prototyped some of it, because he was a programmer as well, which I couldn't do. And I remember really being sad when that couldn't work out, but he was right, I'm sure, because you just don't have that much perception, 3D perception right in front of you. But the thing that remained throughout the entire, almost the entire product, was we always wanted to have AIs who, when you were walking around a corridor and you're making, they would say, hey, is somebody there? That's a concept we had almost from the very beginning, through all those ideas, that AIs would have a state beyond I see you or I don't see you. I'm attacking you or I don't, I'm not, or I have no idea you exist. Because we just thought it was interesting audio stuff to do there. I think I was so taken by digital audio from the System Shock 1, you know, what I heard in System Shock 1, that I was just like, okay, even as crude as the graphics were back then, audio was basically, it was so evolved already. Mm. Once you had digital audio.
Yeah, it was just recording.
It's just recording stuff.
Yeah.
And you had guys like Eric Brosius and Kamal and Greg LaPiccolo, who were so good at doing, you know, audio and ambient beds and things like that, that Looking Glass Audio was so far ahead of everything else that, and visually was so far ahead of the graphics than anybody was doing. Mm. They were doing really authentic audio back from, you know, System Shock 1. And so it was such a powerful tool, and we really wanted to exploit that. And that's something that stayed through all those concepts.
So you're saying even in some of those early iterations, like before it was even a game about a thief,
yes,
it was more like a thief idea possibly grew out of that, just wanting to do more interesting AI states than just,
yes,
I see you or I don't see you.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure, because the actual thief, it's going to be a game about a thief idea, came from Paul Naraff. He came in one day and said, why don't we, because we're still struggling, it's like Dark Camelot, he said, why don't we make it a game about a thief? And I think I liked that idea. I don't know if Doug liked that idea from the outset. I think he grew to like it. I may be misremembering that, but Paul had the idea originally to do a game about a thief, and I just thought it was very clean, because it was like everybody gets it.
Yeah.
And the
title tells you everything.
Yeah, it tells you everything. There was a game years ago called Keith the Thief, but it was kind of goofy. It was like some weird PC game. But I thought there was a lot of room for a game about a thief. And we didn't really know what that meant. So we started sort of, you know, Doug asked me to start thinking about, you know, okay, well, what would that be like systemically? And he and I talked a lot about it. And I started thinking about, like, submarine games and stealth fighter games, because that was, I thought, very similar.
So about unseen enemies.
Yeah, about how powerful you are when you were unseen.
Oh.
And how weak you were when you were spotted. It's like if you play a submarine game like Silent Service or, you know, all those games, that when the enemy can't detect you, you're incredibly powerful. Mm. You have these torpedoes, you strike unseen. But when you get spotted by the destroyers, there's this panic, because you're not going to be able to duke it out with them toe-to-toe.
Yeah.
And that was so the opposite of what shooters were, right? Shooters were generally like, you were just charge in there and shoot people. So we started thinking about what that meant, and that's where I started writing, like, documents about, like, thermocline layers and stuff like that. Like in a submarine, there are layers in the water of different temperatures. You have very cold water and warmer water, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but because of the amount of cold, you know, is the density of cold water versus hot water, they tend to form pockets, and those are called thermocline layers of temperature. And submarines will often go through those, actually form a barrier to sonar and things like that. Mm-hmm. So subs will cross through thermocline layers, and that gives the water, the ocean, a geography and a terrain. And I started thinking about, well, how do we build a terrain that's based upon sound and visuals, and I was originally thinking about sound in particular. I think it was Tom Leonard who came up with the idea. It could be Doug or Tom, I can't remember, or maybe it was even Dan who came up with the idea that you'd also use the light that we draw the information from the shadow, the light maps on the ground to show how much darkness you were in. And so we had sound and, you know, how do you manipulate that? We came up with things like the moss arrows and stuff like that. So I was working with all those guys on that stuff. And
It's interesting you mentioned Silent Service. So were you kind of consciously inspired by that?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like submarines and was part of the game design documents you were writing.
Yes. Yeah, I actually had documents about, I was writing documents about, like, cell fighter games, submarine games, because it was the closest thing I can think of to what we were trying to do. And the key was we wanted to make sure that you had active tools to be stealthy, that you weren't just hiding all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to manipulate the environment, being able to, you know, somebody came with the idea of the water arrows.
Mm-hmm.
I think I came with the idea of the moss arrows. I was more focused on the sound. I think other people were more focused on the light stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being able to, the noisemaker arrows, all those tools that you had, they weren't necessarily about just killing people. Because you look at a stealth fighter game or a sub game, they have noisemakers. Subs have noisemakers.
Mm-hmm.
They have, you know, flares and chaff and things like that. Things that can help you manipulate the information space. And that's what we were thinking about. It's like ThiefWorks, the stealth game is about the information space more than the combat space.
Mm-hmm.
And how can you actively manipulate that information space?
So, yeah, there's not just like a spatial map, but there's like a light map and there's a sound map.
Yeah, there's a sound map and there's all those things go together. And, you know, if you look at it from a shooter standpoint, like if you just built those spaces as a shooter, it's not very interesting because they're really pretty straightforward spaces.
Mm.
But they're all about these other types of information, you know, sound and visuals and things like that. It was a really interesting product to work on. And I think it was probably, you know, there's some really interesting stuff that was happening on that project. And I started turning my attention towards the world. And that was something that I was more on my own on in terms of thinking about what I had to think about.
So is that something you turned to? I'm sure that these all overlap and stuff, but did you turn to the world sort of after really developing a lot of these ideas about the space?
I was involved in the initial ideas, like the, you know, coming up with like that you would use your bow to project things like moss and things on the ground and knock out lights. And noisemaker arrows, but I think in terms of actually making that work and actually making that feel good, I can't. That's really, you know, I think people took that over.
Sure.
You know, a lot of other people took that over.
So were those like initial game design concept documents for individual mechanics?
Yes. Yep. And I think the lighting thing was just so important. The light map thing, though, I think that came from Tom Leonard, and that came from the programming side of somebody saying, "Oh, we could do this, and it would be really cool." And that was obviously really important to it. I don't think I ever wrote about that in a document. I think at that point, once programmers started working on it, we started expanding the group of people who were working on it. Guys like Dan Schmidt came on. Originally, it was just me and Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And guys like Dan. And with lots of consultation with other people, because it was a very collaborative environment. We'd always, I remember Doug would do these meetings where he'd sort of get everybody together and just throw the ideas around and get feedback from people. It was extremely collaborative. But then I sort of got put in a room to go work on the story stuff, and I started... I remember I wanted it to be familiar to, you know, to a fantasy audience in terms of, you know, it's a fantasy world, but I also want to feel really like a film noir, because to me, that's what the closest analog to a thief, to what this character would be like a private detective.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like a Sam Spade private detective. Garrett is a Sam Spade private detective character. And so I started thinking about, you know, a story that would be appropriate. I started thinking about sort of a hybrid aesthetic that's more of this, it's not just on the nose fantasy, it feels more like a noir story, and the sort of steampunky stuff went well with that. And guys like Dan Thron came on, who was an artist, a very, really talented artist, he's the guy who led the team that did all those the movies, you know, those really cool.
Yeah, the great 2D cutscenes that really set the tone.
And he's a big film, he's in the film industry now. He's very cinematically oriented, and he was really able to take that noir stuff and run with it. Everybody, Eric and Greg and the sound guys, you know, really tuned into, you know, casting the right guy, you know, Steve Russell casting the right voice and casting the actors. So I wrote, you know, so I started, you know, coming up with, originally I came up with the, you know, character, originally I called him Palmer, he became Garrett later, this thief, and he's sort of this, he's a man, he's you know, sort of this private detective figure. He does job, he gets hired to do jobs for people, and you know, the beautiful woman shows up in his office and gives him this job, and he thinks it's straightforward and simple, and of course it
ends up being. See the film noir connection there, like when Victoria shows up and she's like, I work for this employer.
Yeah, I work for this guy.
Yeah, and he's shady. Yeah.
And he ends up getting double-crossed by them, and he's getting used, and it's totally, you know, like a Chinatown or a kind of story. And that was, I thought that was cool because we were doing it not in a film noir setting, but in a fantasy setting. And I was really drawn to that. And I really wanted Garrett to be not a hero, but to be more of an anti-hero. Because that's the films I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up watching films in the 70s, you know, when I was a young kid. You know, watching Blade Runner and Chinatown and all these sort of compromises.
Yeah, Chinatown is actually a really interesting connection now that you mentioned it. I never even thought of it that way.
Well, it's the archetype. You know, this guy, he was involved with, you know, he sort of had a different past, but he sort of failed. You know, he's sort of living on the outs of society. I remember one dispute we had, one internal debate is there was a mission in Thief. This is about how dark a character Garrett was. Because remember, this is the time where heroes were in games were kind of heroes, you know?
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of anti-heroes in games at the time. And I really wanted to push in the anti-hero direction. There was the mission where you get, where there's a mob boss in the town. I can't remember. Ramirez, I think.
I remember that.
And originally I wrote the mission breakout of that, the original mission breakout that he, it ends up, it is, originally I wrote it that a bunch of merchants who are getting squeezed by him, who are paying a protection racket to him, hire you to kill him. And you're like, okay, because that's what you do. That's, you know, you'll take on whatever job because you're Garrett and you're kind of a shady figure. And then that mission plays out. There was a lot of the designers that looked like were not comfortable with that. They wanted, so it ended up being that he tries to kill you first.
Yeah, that's the mission where you're going to buy something and then suddenly an arrow comes through the window and it was meant for you, and then you follow the guys back to his place and you end up... you can kill him, but the mission is not to kill him.
And I think that I was always... I like the fact that it's just you get hired to kill this guy because you're... Look, you're a guy who breaks into people's houses and kills you know, the guards and stuff. And I liked... I really like pushing on the anti-hero side of it. And I think it's more of a reflection of... You know, you think of now in terms of a game, that wouldn't even be a...
Yeah, it would be... No concern.
You know, there's no concern. But then I think it was kind of, it was too far. It was a little too far. I don't know, maybe it was the right thing, maybe it's the wrong thing. But I remember being a little frustrated by that. But the character basically was the character we conceived at the beginning. And us, you know, I think he came out very similar to what the conception of him was.
That's actually interesting. You just talk about the character being dark, because one of the things that strikes me about that game is that the highest difficulty requires you to kill nobody. And I'm wondering, would that have conflicted with the darker...
The very brilliant notion of having different mission goals for different difficulties like happened after I left. And so I think it was really good for the game. I think that probably if I were to be working on it at the time, I would have tried to reflect it as... something that was, there was a benefit to him in the story that, it just was, he was less likely to get caught. You know, like, I always like those stories that, like, the guy, you know, the smart crook doesn't, he makes as few waves as possible because it's a problem for him, not because he has a moral reason. It's because it's less likely to come back and cause him trouble later on.
Well, that's also stealth, right? That's like social or political stealth or whatever you would call it as well. So
you don't want to leave any fingerprints of any kind. And I would probably want to reflect that in the story as much as possible, because I think it is cool. I mean, it's a really clever game design notion. Those guys, the really smart guys working on that game. But it was a pretty satisfying, certainly as my first product that I was involved with, it came out, I think, you know, it was very much the game that, I can't say it's a game we intended it to be, because I think it evolved, especially the game design, got really found so late in the day.
Yeah, I've heard that about the project before, yeah.
I can't say it was like, oh, well, it's exactly the game that we planned, because I don't think we did. I think if we had planned it brilliantly, you know, like it would have, and we knew everything from the start, it would have been a smoother development cycle. I think aesthetically it definitely came out what I saw in
my head. It came out well. Seems like a lot of people were happy with
it. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm of two minds. I'm not a huge gamer. It's weird. I'm not a huge fan of stealth games as a gamer. I don't really like stealth. I'm a little impatient, I think, as a gamer. Like, whenever I play, it goes back to when I used to play war games when I was a kid, I'd always be the guy who, like, rush my troops up right away, and my brother would always, like, you know, destroy me in board games and war games, because I had no patience. And I'm kind of an impatient gamer, which is weird, having my first game be, like, you know, a stealth game. It's all about patience. But I think certainly aesthetically it was a really, especially for the time, an extremely consistent aesthetic experience.
One thing that strikes me about Thief, compared to obviously the work that you've done since at Irrational, is there seems to be these kind of dichotomies in that world, right? It's kind of like you've got the Order and Chaos and the Trickster and the Hammerites and all this stuff, and I'm wondering, is that something that, was that coming from you, and is that something that you feel like, does that connect at all? Because, I mean, if you look at, like, System Shock 2 or Bioshock, you see similar kinds of dichotomies that are being played out in those worlds. Is that something that just strikes a chord with you?
Well, when I was working on Thief, originally, the only two forces I had to play were the Church, the Hammerites, and the Trickster. Those are sort of the competing forces in the world. You know, one of technology and order and structure, and one of chaos and nature, and you were sort of caught in between them. And I think that's clearly a theme that I tend to be drawn to. That there are these powers that be, and in System Shock 2, you had Shodan, who was essentially an individualistic fascist, and the Many, which were a socialist collective.
Yeah,
and I remember one of the interesting challenges in all those things is to show what was appealing about them. Like, with the Many, it was really important to me that when I wrote them, that you sense that they were, that it was kind of nice to be in that world where you were cared for and loved and you were part of a group, that you're part of a symphony. I remember that's, I came up with this musical metaphor.
Oh, yeah.
That they would talk about, you're joining our symphony. Because, it can be very comforting. Because I struggled to find, as a very individualistic person, I always struggled to find what was appealing about that world. And so I always try to do that. So,
why would somebody join it?
Why would somebody like that? Because people do, right? People, being part of a group is very important. It's not very important to me. And I've always been to a fault, an individualist.
Sure.
And so I totally understood Shodan more than I understood the Many, but it's really important to me to understand the Many. And same with, I had a harder time understanding the Hammerites than I did the Trickster, because
they do seem kind of just like coarse and kind of crazy.
Yeah, but I think if I had gone on to actually write like all the dialogue in the game and stuff like that, like I do on Argus, I probably would have spent a lot of time thinking about what they did for that world. Because, they took the world out of darkness, they brought buildings and they brought, and that's why their Jesus figure was a builder. He was the guy who took them out of the wilderness.
There's something else interesting about that story that didn't occur to me until years later, and I know you only worked on the first one, correct?
Yeah.
Is that the Trickster is real, but the Master Builder doesn't appear to be? Or this is a deliberate ambiguity?
Because his works are not necessarily his works, but the works of that force are around, right?
Yeah.
There is technology, and there is, and so his power, the effects of that movement are very present. Where we need to make the Trickster real because there's nothing he lost, So he has to demonstrate his realness through his presence.
Well, I definitely, that makes a lot of sense. It was just something that it just seemed like an interesting aspect of the I guess cosmology would be the right word, but the idea that maybe some gods are real and some gods aren't, and I was never sure about whether or not
I have to go back and think about whether I really thought about,
like, was he out there somewhere?
Was real. I don't know if I ever really thought.
It doesn't.
About that.
Well, it's
no, it's an interesting question.
I didn't think about it either until until a few years ago. I remember playing it again and being like, "Wait a minute, is there even a Master Builder? Is this like a made up religion that's not based on an actual deity?" But it's an interesting ambiguity.
It's an interesting question. Definitely. I mean, he's obviously inspired by a Jesus figure. That he's this guy who, I can't remember.
He's a savior, right?
He saved them from the wilderness, from the terrors of the wilderness.
Yeah,
and that, there was a world before and a world now. He was a transitional figure in that world, in the same way that in Christian mythology or religion,
they were saved from sin. You know, there's a, sure. The world was saved from sin. He saved them from the wilderness. You know, this horrible, terrifying wilderness that was embodied in this scary, you know, this scary motherfucker known as the Trickster. And that his world was, and that the Trickster character came from. There's a play by it's a Greek play. I can't remember which one of the authors I read in college, which is about Pan. Or, you know, there's a million names for him.
But, yeah, but the Trickster evokes Dionysius. That kind of.
I remember, like, he had all these women around. They were always covered in blood, and they were doing sacrifices. Like, it was a crazy, crazy violent orgy world. You know, all in the woods. Everybody's naked. There are people getting killed. There are people having sex. It was like this crazy, crazy world. And there was a reformer. You know, the builder is this reformer who comes in and changes that. And he changes it through technology.
Yeah.
And those forces were directly in conflict. Yeah, so it's definitely a theme in what we do, because I think it's a theme. The reason I think it's a theme is not because, like, oh, I'm just drawn to this theme. I just think that's what life is. Like, when you look around, any culture, you always find sort of these diametric viewpoints that calcify around any concept. You know, you go to Europe in the '30s and '40s, you've got, you know, fascism and communism sort of coming head to head. Here, you know, in this country now, you've got, you know, a left and a right, you know, and you often find these diametrically opposed forces forming in any society. And so to me, it's just, if you're going to talk about a society, you just naturally have to sort of identify who the big players are in a society.
Yeah, and I think those games, they put you as a character into these worlds and kind of show you these dichotomies, and then they're not necessarily asking you to choose, although it seems like there are characters in the world who are asking you to choose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
it's not like you can, like, ultimately side with one, or maybe you can. I don't know. It depends on the game, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, some of it, I think, is that, you know, if you choose, that's not a that's a pretty scary place to go to, because, like, the people who choose usually end up like, yeah, I kind of feel personally like I'm trapped. That I feel like a person trapped. Like, I'm not ready to choose. I never really feel comfortable choosing a side. I'm not a sports guy. Like I don't, like, people get so committed to a particular, boy, I'm probably gonna get in a lot of trouble for this. You know, people choose a sports team with such certainty and they get so behind it. I think there are people who want to join teams and people who don't. The people who are opposed to being on teams. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of always been the I'm not on a team kind of guy.
Yeah, well,
but I'm fascinated by teams.
It's interesting going back to Thief 2, because you said you came up with the kind of the chaos and order, the Trickster and the Hammerites, but you have that third group, the Keepers, right? And Garrett sort of doesn't want to be on with the two religions, but he also doesn't want to be part of his own group. Like, he's, like, in the middle of this triangle.
Yeah. And I think the Keeper is something that came up after I left, and I think it's sort of in the same way that, you know, Jack Nicholson's character was in the police force in Chinatown, you know, like, and he left because he wasn't comfortable with that order. I think the Keepers are very similar to that. Sort of, he was in something more ordered and more together, but he viewed as corrupt and left.
Did you play the subsequent Thief games?
A long time ago. Long time ago.
Do you remember how the third one ended?
No.
Yeah. Anyway, it's about the Keepers becoming so corrupt, you know, they have to be taken down on their own. So it seems to extend a lot of those themes. You had mentioned that you didn't write most of the dialogue for Thief, but you were more like a high-level story guy.
I did a story guy. I wrote the initial. I wrote the story outline, like the parts, you know, with the fact that who you are, the Trickster, the Victoria, the you losing your eye, like the act react structure. I did all that. I wrote some prototype cutscenes. You know, the opening cutscenes. Some scenes came out very similar, but then I left. You know, I don't want to overly take credit for anything. I mean, a lot of the hard work on the product comes, like, towards the end of the project. And I was doing System Shock 2 then. But I sort of set the tone of that war. You know, originally was there to set the tone of the world, who are the major players, and the three-act structure.
And also the themes of the world, too, it seems like.
Except for the Keepers. That was after my time.
So that's interesting. So it sounds like you had mentioned that you didn't write, you did more of the high-level stuff on that. And you said that's unlike what you've done at Irrational. So was it on System Shock 2 kind of right away that you were more into kind of like also doing the high-level stuff, but also more the low-level stuff?
Well, it's more of a function that if I had stayed on Thief, I would have done more of the low-level stuff, because that just tends, you start with the high-level stuff and you go into the low-level stuff. So like on System Shock 2, you know, coming up with all those high-level things, then I actually had to go write all the dialogue and write all the script, you know, and write all the AI arcs and things like that.
So
had I stayed on it.
Were you, were there any other writers, or was it like...
System Shock 2, maybe a few lines, but that was almost entirely me at that point.
Okay, so it was like you coming up with kind of the world, and then... Sounds like a lot of work to go through and do a lot of...
Yeah, but, you know, it's a sense of... It's a lot of work, but it's also, as my job, you know, what I generally do on the projects, I generally don't build the levels myself. That sounded way overblown, even as it was. No, there's no way somebody could build in a modern game all levels himself. I don't build any of the levels myself. I did mechanical work on System Shock 2. I actually did the in-engine animate, like the narrative sequences, like, you know, at the beginning, the woman running by getting shotgun, you know, where you go by
the first where you see through the window.
Yeah, I built almost all of those kind of sequences, those narrative sequences in the engine, but that's like the last time I did any engine work on a game.
So would you say that your process is kind of like the high level vision guy and also low level dialogue guy, and then trying to keep that all in focus for the people who are supporting that with things like level design, character design?
Yeah, you know, the process really hasn't changed since System Shock 2, which is I do like the literal high level, like here's what happens, and this is what this level is. Here's the three act, I start with the three act structure. Like in Bioshock, for example, three act structure is first you're trying to get out of the city to the submarine, and the submarine blows up, and then you try to get to Ryan and kill him, and that gets
and
then you go to Fontaine. And that's like the three act structure. And we have a similar one in Thief, you know, the camera at the end of the first act, the second act, you lose your eye, and it's all about getting your eye back.
Yeah.
It's always about escalating the stakes for the character. So come up with the three act structure, then you say, okay, well, how do we express this three act structure in missions? And come up with missions that support that three act structure. And then give those missions to, you know, work with level designers on those missions, and I review their progress on that, you know, all the time. And they sort of say, oh, if we do this, we do that, and I review that. And then I actually have to go write the actual supporting dialogue, which is, that's a lot. That's all a lot. It's everybody, games are a lot of work, you know?
Yeah.
But I think writing the dialogue is what keeps me honest, because I can come up with a really, quote, big idea, like, oh, it would be great if we had this, and at the end of the day, I have to be part of the, has to be shared responsibility for actually making sure that idea gets expressed, because it's really easy to come up with big ideas, but the problem is how do you express that idea in a game? Like, something I often say to my team, and they probably want to kill me when I say it, is like, oh, that's going to be really awesome when I read that in the novel. Which is what I'm trying to say is that in a novel you could get that idea across, but how you can get that across, and if you have a much smaller, you know, novels are like, you know, broadband of information you can get across to a viewer. Games, in terms of narrative information, are more like dial-up, you know, they're more like, you know, 56K. And how much narrative information, without going to cutscenes, because I'm not a big fan of cutscenes.
Yeah, obviously.
How do you do that? How do you get that information across in a very narrow band function? And that's what I loved about System Shock 1 originally, was how much narrative they got across in that, you know, with those audio logs in the world. They told so much of the story, you know, for the time. They told a story in the world. They told a story through the audio logs and that.
And even the environmental stuff, too, like the writing on the walls.
Absolutely. And, you know, we run... Basically, what Bioshock was, is Bioshock was taking that very basic concept. Like, they would have a couple of things. That's all they could do back then. And I was like, let's make a whole game where it's about telling that story in the world. Because now we have the graphics and the tool and the resources to do it. And those very basic things, you know, were such powerful tools. And I just want to run with that. Because there's so much you could do there.
I know you have to go pretty soon, don't you?
Yeah, I have a couple minutes.
I have one more question. If just from my point of view, if I look at the kind of design shift, and I know Irrational is a totally different company with a different philosophy of game design, But if you look at System Shock 1 and System Shock 2, there's more of a kind of a game genre kind of a focus on it, like the fact that there are these stats and it's more like a... Like
System Shock 1, if you go back to it, actually doesn't have RPG system.
Oh, did I say 1? I meant 2.
Yeah, 2 is quite a different game from
2
one.
Is definitely that, and I'm wondering, was that something that you decided for audience reasons, where you're like, you know, I love System Shock 1, but nobody played it, so in order for people to play it, maybe we have to, like, make it more of a commercial genre, or is it just like you really wanted there to be stats in there working that way, because that's what you
Here's why we had stats in 2. It's really simple. The engine wasn't a very good shooter engine. It wasn't a very good action engine.
Because it was the thief engine, right?
It was the thief engine. It was kind of ran kind of like a dog. It did certain things really well. There were tons of objects in the world, and tons of detail, relatively for the time, a ton compared to like Doom, a ton of detail in the world. What you couldn't do is like run in anything. You know, you couldn't. It was a when we got the engine, it was a software renderer with no colored lights and single player. We had to turn it into working with the Looking Glass guys into, you know, it ended up getting turned into a hardware only game, because at the time that was a big deal.
You could run it in software mode, I remember at the time.
I don't think System Shock 2.
Thief, I'm remembering.
But we had colored lights, which was that was a big deal at the time. Thief didn't. They just had black. They just had on or off lights or we had color lights that we had to be hardware only because the look of System Shock is so defined by the colors of the levels. Mm-hmm. So the color, like, that was almost all the lighting. We needed something that made the game feel rich, I thought. And knowing the limitation of the engine, having worked on Thief, the idea to do RPG stuff came out of necessity. It's like, let's make it feel more of a pace of an RPG than a shooter, because we can't compete on the shooter front. Mm-hmm. And that was true. You know, at the end of the day, like, just getting the machine gun to fire, because there was a system, this object system that they developed, that Mark LeBlanc did, that was very, very powerful for populating the world with lots of stuff, but there was a huge overhead on each object. So when you had to fire a machine gun, it took actual, like, real time to generate each bullet in the machine gun, like, and it had, that's the only way they could have done. There wasn't like a cheap way to do it. So just firing a machine gun was almost, at the beginning, until we did a lot of optimization, it's almost impossible to do, because that engine wasn't designed to be generating a bullet every eighth of a second.
Yeah,
it was designed for a guy with an arrow to be shooting, you know,
once every 10 seconds. Yeah.
And so we really had limitations, and that innovation of RPG and shooter combined came out of necessity. I think a lot of inventions come out of necessity. Like, how are we going to make this competitive? Well, we can't, so let's do something different. We can't be a competitive shooter. So System Shock 1, much more of a shooter. There's no stats, you just get objects in System Shock 1. We evolved that for System Shock 2 really out of necessity.
Hmm. Okay. I'm sure you have to go, because I know you...
So this has been great. I wish I had more time.
Oh, no.
This has been really fun, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Reminiscing.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.